Today's show is brought to you by Traeger Grills, the very best way to cook meat, the very best way to cook anything. Go to TraegerGrills.com or Traeger.com. There's a lot of different ways to do it. Just go anywhere. Go to your local hardware store. Traeger's everywhere. I love Traeger. I personally use Traeger on a daily basis. I use it at least 2 to 3 times a week and 2 to 3 times a day. So think about that. Think about the math on that. And now, let's Beehive. You are looking alive on a Friday. Boy, is it Friday. Boy, are you alive. My name is Clint Betts.
My name is Chris Roll.
So much going on in the world today, Chris.
Let's just jump right in, dude. Let's do it.
Let's see what's going on today in the Beehive. Governor Spencer Cox hosts a monthly Let Me Talk to the Governor radio show on KSL. He did one yesterday, and controversy ensued. Here's why.
All right, let's go to our next caller. That is David in Highland. Good afternoon, David. What is your question for the governor?
Hi, Governor. The Utah Jazz is excluding white children from consideration for their scholarship program. Do you think this is racist? And what will you do to prevent the Utah Jazz from acting in this racist manner?
Well, I don't think it's racist. In fact, I think it's in response to, unfortunately, some very difficult and racist injustices that have happened in our community for a long time. And I'll tell you what I'm going to do for the Utah Jazz. Absolutely nothing. Because you know what? I believe in the Constitution, and I believe in the freedom of businesses to make decisions and decisions that are right for them. Your kid or my kid, they have no right to the Utah Jazz's money, and the Utah Jazz and Ryan Smith can do the things that they want to do with their funds and their revenues. And look, it's an awesome program, and it's something that we should be celebrated. The cool thing is that the Utah Jazz have more wins than any team in the nation, which means that there are more scholarships available for kids in our state, and those kids, these are kids who are in at-risk communities. These are kids who have struggled. These are kids who have not had access to the same opportunities that my kids and your kids have had. We live in a nation that does have a very difficult history, and sometimes we try to ignore it. A history of racial injustice, a history where of course slavery being the most severe and awful example of that, but look, that stuff just doesn't go away overnight. And kids, we're working very hard on equity, making sure that every kid in our state has the same opportunities as others. And so, looking for ways to lift communities that have been historically and disproportionately impacted isn't racist at all. In fact, it's a great way to overcome racism. And I'm really proud of the Jazz and the great things that they're doing there.
Governor Cox's office live tweeted the show, and this is what they put on Twitter regarding that exchange. They said, David from Highland asks if it's racist that the Utah Jazz excludes white children from the team's scholarship program. Answer, it's not racist. Ryan Smith and the Jazz can do what they want with their funds. All kids should have equal opportunities, and we're proud of the Jazz. At the beginning of this year, Ryan Smith went on ESPN's The Woj Pod and announced that the Jazz were starting an initiative to award a college scholarship to someone from an underrepresented or minority community in Utah every time the team won a game. The Jazz now have the best record in the league. And because Ryan is a wonderful person, the team has awarded 44 scholarships so far, even though they only have 41 regular season wins at the moment. Ryan is including preseason wins. again because Ryan is a wonderful person. According to Deseret News, the first 30 scholarships will go to students who will start college this fall at either BYU, SUU, Weber State, Utah, Utah State, or UVU. Scholarships pledged during the remainder of this season will be awarded for the 2022-2023 school year. Scholarships will cover tuition, books, fees, and room and board for the recipient's full undergraduate education at one of those schools. How incredible is that? Here's what Quinn Snyder told the Deseret News. It was something that the players were excited about when they heard about it. Obviously, any extra motivation to win is welcome. I think just in general, giving a young man or young woman the opportunity to develop, evolve, and embrace education is something that's incredibly important, and the diversity component benefits everybody. I want to be clear about what the Utah Jazz and Ryan Smith are doing. They're giving full ride scholarships to someone from an underrepresented or minority community in Utah every time the team wins a game. A full ride scholarship, a life-changing opportunity. They could do nothing. They're not the government, and Ryan's not an elected official. He and the Utah Jazz can do whatever they want with their money. And in this case, as well as Five for the Fight and so many other initiatives, Ryan has chosen to do some good, to change things, to do something, to be in action. Here's what a publication, ironically called The Federalist, had to say about this whole thing. Their article starts, Utah Governor Spencer Cox defended racism against white kids during a question and answer session with constituents on Thursday. So freaking dumb. In that same article, The Federalist said this. When asked if Cox believes that excluding white people from amenities, finances, and programs is racist, the governor's office reiterated his former claim but said it did not apply to government scholarships. Governor Cox believes the Utah Jazz has every right to act according to their own corporate values and issue scholarships to whomever they choose. Government scholarships, on the other hand, are not based on race, a spokesperson from the governor's office told The Federalist. How odd is it that Governor Cox had to explain to a publication called The Federalist that a private company can do whatever it wants with its money. I'm proud of Ryan Smith, and I'm proud of Governor Cox for standing up for what's right. And I'm tired of this shit coming out of the state that I love and have lived in my whole life. Let me repeat something to the clowns criticizing what Ryan and the Utah Jazz are doing. They could do nothing. They're not obligated to do anything. And they don't owe you a damn thing. Ryan, someone I know, a friend of mine, is a man of action. In this case, and in so many other examples, he chose action over being a cornball on social media. Emerson said, an ounce of action is worth a ton of theory. I want those criticizing this amazing scholarship program that didn't even have to exist to think about that. An ounce of action is worth a ton of theory. When I think of Emerson's quote, I think of my son Henry. He's a masterful teacher. And Henry is always in action. To begin each morning, Henry runs to Penny, our Cavapoo. It's a mix between a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel and Poodle. Gives her a giant bear hug and says, "Hi, Penny!" He then says hi to everyone else in the house. With enthusiasm, Mark Mad Dog Mattson, look at his YouTube clips, would have trouble matching. But it's Penny who gets the first hug. She never leaves Henry's side. When Henry eats, she eats. When Henry cries, she cries. It's the cutest thing in the world. When Henry sleeps, she sleeps right by his side. Their love for each other is expressed through action. Of course, their options are limited. One is a 2-year-old with a limited vocabulary, and the other is a dog. And yet, they flawlessly communicate in the most beautiful of languages, love. You always know how Henry feels. He's unambiguous, genuine, and unafraid to express himself. In Henry's presence, love and understanding emanate. That's how I want to live my life. Isn't that how you want to live your life? That's how Ryan Smith lives his life. He's doing something. What are you doing? Here's a tweet Governor Cox had to send out last night. I hope you will take the time to listen to what I actually said. But look, folks, if you're outraged by a private individual trying to help disadvantaged minority kids go to college, then I'm definitely not your guy. That's my governor. It seems no matter what you do these days, you're going to get criticized. It often feels like the best thing to do is nothing. To hide, to keep a low profile, to be selfish, and not get in the arena at all. Resist that. We need more people in the thick of things. We need more people in action. Anyone can sit on the sidelines and tweet or criticize. For those doing that in this case, I ask again, what are you doing? An ounce of action is worth a million tweets. Get off the sideline. Get off social media and get in the game. We need you. And if you can't do that, then maybe show an ounce of empathy and understanding for those in the arena trying to make a difference. The Utah Jazz are changing lives with this scholarship program. This is unambiguously a good thing, and not an inch will be given to those who try to tear down something or someone doing good. Not an inch. And now, why though?
You ready to laugh with me there, pal?
Let's do it!
Did you get yourself ready? You want to take a deep breath? You want me to lead you in a breathing exercise?
Let's do it.
There's a little... Okay, let's start with five deep inhales. Count to five. Okay, here we go. The official animal of Utah is the Rocky Mountain elk. Why, though? So, I mean, I've been on record many times. Not a big animal guy. I stump for birds and not much else, okay? And there are very few beasts of the wild that I find to, like, truly be noble in the sense that people always talk about. that's a noble lion. Oh, look at that majestic, noble dog, stuff like that. I usually don't buy into it. However, the Rocky Mountain elk is one of the very few creatures that kind of checks that box.
It's beautiful.
For me. Because if you see the picture that Weston can pull up here on the screen, every single Google image you can go and find about a Rocky Mountain elk, it's snapped out in the wild. They're these huge creatures, huge antlers, and they're always going around. In my mind, they're making the weird elk noise. I don't think that's the noise, but something along those lines. I think that was a bugle
it's
in my mind.
Nothing like.
Do you know how
that's like Tim that Allen from Home Improvement?
Yeah. I think that was a Home Improvement. Maybe I should have practiced that before the show. Do you know what they actually sound like? I think it's. Oh, wow, very good. I should have had you lead with this. I didn't know that you had such a good sound.
So I
imagine that sound in my mind. They're always up on a peak. Mm-hmm. You never see a Rocky Mountain elk like down in a valley just kind of schlumming around like, oh, here, I'm going to eat some of these grasses or something. They're always at a peak, just kind of staring off into the sunset, which is the most majestic pose that anyone could ever have. If you take a bunch of pictures, the only one that anyone will go, that's kind of majestic. It's when you're on high ground, looking off into the skyline or the sunset, and everybody goes, man, that guy, he's a little more majestic than I think. Mm-hmm. So already I'm buying into this. Is the state animal of Utah. You know, we've gone over a couple things in the past about whether or not this should be the state icon, and most of them I disagree with. The most notable one, I want, you know, Pepperidge Farms goldfish to be our main calling card.
That's not a bad idea.
However, the Rocky Mountain elk, the more that I kind of like learned about them and what was going on, I go, this is pretty good stuff. I mean, this is a really cool animal, right? And it got my mind thinking. Because despite the fact that I don't like most animals, the more that I do a why though, and there's an animal involved, and the more I go and read about them, the more I understand there are scouts for every animal. You know, they go out in the wild and they truly scout them. Much in the same way that you go to the NFL combine, you're timing the 40, you're measuring the hand size, you're doing all that stuff. I kind of think my ultimate destiny is to be an animal scout, but for a Rocky Mountain elk, like it's like something I truly respect. And I follow it around all the time. You and me could do it together. It would actually be way freaking fun, dude. Imagine when we're out there. You got a tape measure. We're like looping it around the thighs going, oh, okay.
Yeah, so we're not going to be able to do that.
Why not? If we're good scouts, we can.
How would a scout do that?
A scout? Well, if you're a good scout, you get every single correct measure. No. A true scout, a good scout. I'm not talking about some like run-of-the-mill has-been. I'm talking about the cutting edge scouting industry.
How does the elk just stand there and let you measure it?
Because we become friends. I go, listen here, buddy, I'm on your behalf. I'm like proselytizing how cool of a creature you are. I call you noble, but I want to get the truth out. You know, a lot of people, they say you got smaller thighs. There's not as much meat as like a black bear or something. If you would allow me to measure real quick. I'd be more than willing to go and spread the truth on your behalf. That's how we could do it. It's just a simple, you talked about empathy. Empathy exists between humans and animals. I could go to a Rocky Mountain elk and have a nice measured conversation and they can understand where I'm coming from. And they go, that guy means me no harm. He's not here to try to shoot me. He just wants to measure my thighs. Mm-hmm. And I truly would. The part about Rocky Mountain elk that is kind of strange, but this applies to all animals is there's always, so first of all, you can hunt Rocky Mountain elk.
Oh, yeah.
Which I don't really...
Why did you end that sentence with a question mark?
Well, because I was confused. I always assumed in my mind that a state animal would be protected because it was a state animal, right?
No.
Why are you scoffing at me assuming that?
What do you think? We're protecting seagulls?
Wait, can I kill a seagull?
You can kill whatever you want.
I don't know if that's true. You can
Go
or
ahead.
Cannot.
Go ahead and shoot a seagull.
You cannot.
Who's
going to
stop you?
Well,
oh, you can't? You can't? I've done it several times.
Okay.
All of a sudden, I can't?
If there's a nice, enterprising seagull scout who witnesses this, I mean, you call it the wildlife people right then and there, and you're going
What do they do?
The
what do they do when you kill a seagull?
They come off, they tranquilize you, they take you back to the headquarters, they strap you in a chair, and they question you, dude.
Did you kill it? Well, yeah. Let me go.
And they go, Can he kill a state bird?
That's a stumper.
And they're like, I don't know. I was doing this because you wanted to do this. And then they let you go, maybe. No, here's why I'm confused by this. You cannot kill a Rocky Mountain elk, which is our actual state animal, a very noble and majestic beast. Mm-hmm. You can kill that, okay, legally.
You have to have a tag and stuff.
Well, yeah, but legally you can do that. Mm-hmm. You can't do that for like just a pedestrian animal like a dog or a cat. You can't kill one of those.
You keep saying you can't, but I feel like you can.
I can't go and get a dog tag at Sportsman's Warehouse and go, I'd love to go and hunt a dog today. Here's $20. I took hunter's safety. Can I go and hunt that
dog?
It
probably is a fine. If you kill a dog, there's a fine.
Dude, you would go to jail if you killed a dog.
You think so?
Yes. It's a felony in the...
Really?
I promise you it's a felony. Oh, yeah. I've looked into all this stuff, dude. You think my research just extends to Rocky Mountain?
Yeah, you would know more about that than I would, because you hate dogs. You're like, can I kill this?
I'm like 12 years old.
What are the punishments?
Well, when I was young, everybody was going to hunter safety, because that's just the area that we grew up in. And I'm not... that's just not really my cup of tea, but I was like kind of wanting to fall in with the crowd. And I go, is it worth it to go into hunter safety? I got to go to like classes and stuff and like take the test. I don't love that idea. But then I'm like, can I get a dog tag? Like, I'd love to just hunt, some golden retriever that's running around the mountains.
Oh my God.
Everybody's going to love that. Okay, back to what I was talking about, though. What is actually very strange is as part of this like hunt process, you go out in the wild and you make the noises of the animal, which I always find to be...
The bugle's cool.
I find to be immensely fun. It doesn't matter what it is. Like, for example, one of the people that I golf with... Actually, a lot of the people that I golf with are big hunters, and so they're always trying to give me these little tidbits of wisdom because for some reason they think that I'm the appropriate party to share these with. And so there'll be ducks around at some of the courses we play, and they'll get way, way, way excited. They go, oh, man. And they start doing the, if I just had my shotgun here, and they'll start making duck calls to the ducks, and they'll do it in front of me, a person who's not used to this, and I'll just like, they act like it's the most normal thing, and I'm sitting there like trying to hit a 7-iron into a green while these 50-year-old dudes are going, and the ducks are like running over, and they go, oh man, if I just had a shotgun right now. I'm like, is this what you do when you're out hunting? And so then I think about how much funnier it is out in the wild.
That's exactly what they
where mean. You go out, and it's like, it's almost funnier if nobody's there to witness it. Because now, in my mind, you're out on a boat on Utah Lake, let's say, and it's early morning. It's just you, and there's nothing around. And you're just sitting in a boat making that sound.
Yeah.
Quack, quack. You're quacking a bunch, and then, like, ducks come over, and you try to shoot them.
Well, they have a little thing.
Exactly. So that's what they tell me. They go... But if you're a big-time hunter, you know all the sounds just with your vocal cords. Mm-hmm. Now, granted, you can accentuate it with the nice calls, but, like, you're actually pretty good at the elk sound, as we found out.
I'm really good.
You could go out in the wild.
I do.
You're the little bit of bait for us as a scouting unit, mm-hmm. where you go and do that. You do the bugle. I think that's what it was. Little rooster combined with a... And the elk's like, is that guy doing a rooster call? I start thinking about it from the animal's perspective, you know? Like, some of the ducks, they probably aren't the smartest, and they go, who is that sexy thing out there in the weeds? And they drive over there. They fly over there. They don't drive.
Gotcha.
I love they drive over there. They're in their own boat. They come over, and then they
what
get
are you guys doing?
And then they get shot at. However, the smarter ones, they're like flying up above so they can always have the nice vantage point. And they just look down, and it's my friend who's 55 in a coat. And he's like, quack, quack. And they go back. They go, have you seen that guy out there? What the hell is wrong with him? What is that guy doing?
That's especially true for an elk in the wilderness.
Of course it's
because they're smarter than ducks, I imagine. I imagine ducks
elk
have pea brain.
Elk are incredibly smart creatures.
So elk, super smart. And you're like,
so,
and then like,
is that what? Is that guy
I can
in a,
see you hey they're like waving their antlers hey I see you
did that guy put a cardboard box in that tree and he's sitting in it and making a rooster noise like these majestic creatures at the highest peak so they can see everything they're just looking down at you and you're rooster crowing and they're like that guy's got a gun and he's trying to lure me in with a rooster crow?
Wait, like, little buddy.
What's going on with this guy?
One thing I don't like, I don't care if you hunt or not. I'm not one of those people. I get.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want.
One of the few things I've ever been passionate about is today in the BI, right? So I don't get passionate very often. But you can do it or not. But the thing that you should do is just bring a camera instead of a gun. Because they're so beautiful and like keep them out there. These elk, deer, a little rodent.
See, this is what I don't like. There's always these animals that just get pushed to the side. Why are we pissing
so
all over
a deer
now?
Looks nothing like what we're looking at right now. Like, a deer is nothing like an elk. That's no offense to deer.
Yeah, that's true.
But elk are superior to deer. There's just no question. When you see an elk in the woods, like, that's a moment in your life. I remember every elk I've ever seen. I don't remember every deer. I saw a deer last night. Dumb.
Here's where I feel for the deer, though. Like, we've talked about it on this show. You and I, we fall on the very extreme edge of the beta category, you know, when it comes to alphas and betas.
Extreme.
Extreme. And I'm not saying like a mid-level beta. I'm saying
we're out there.
Even in the land of the betas, we are betas, right?
Betas own us. Normal betas, they own us.
So like, even within our own subset, we're like, I'll do whatever you say, other beta. just lay it on me thick, man. But then when you see an alpha, you know, like the big gym guy, and he's got tons of pre-workout pumping through his blood, and he goes, go get me a soda at the gas station. I go, for sure, dude. I'll grab you two. We'll do anything to please him, right? We'll do anything.
So sure, big guy.
I hear about these poor deer that we're going, oh, they're nowhere near the elk. And that's true.
They're not.
At the same time, there's a lot of parallels I see within the deer that apply to my own life. The deer probably come across an elk, and the elk's majestic. They got the big horns. Mm. They go, go and get me some berries. And the deer goes, for sure, dude, you're so cool. Oh, man, I wish I could be you so bad. That's not a reason to, like, just go and trash on these
deer.
No,
I don't. I don't think, again, like, I would bring a camera instead of a gun for the deer.
You bring a camera and you're just snapping pictures of deer. These beta deer gathering berries for the master elk.
Oh, look at this. These are my people right here. Yeah, I could never be an elk for the
super
deer.
Super slinking around.
A young 2-point? I could easily be a young 2-point. Like, you know those bucks that you can barely tell they're even bucks? That's me. That's me. Like, it is.
You actually have
it is a buck.
You actually have to touch their head to feel if they have horns or not.
It is a buck, but you really got to look close. That's me.
I'm the sideberry guy.
You're a buck that got his horns cut off.
Yeah. And I go along. I can't even pick the berries because the prickles hurt my hands. And you hand the berries to me. I just have my hooves out. And I'm like, hurry, dude. We got to get back to that elk pronto, man. He's going to lose all respect for us. That's a huge problem. Okay. There's a stat about the Rocky Mountain elk that I'm really interested in when I came across it. And this ties back into my thing about it's pretty cool to be a scout because you get to observe stuff that's very interesting.
Cool.
So the main thing that I found out about that I was fascinated by, elk, they only breed in the fall. It's called the rut, which is a great thing. Don't you wish that we had that as humans?
Like,
the
only time I only breed in the fall. Look at all my kids. No, this is an actual thing that I do. I only breed in the fall.
So, okay.
So all my kids are born in like August or September. That's the fall.
Well, I thought it was like, how long are people pregnant? Isn't it 8 months or 9 months? I don't think you understand how childbearing works. How am I
That's
having to explain this? I breed in the fall. My kids are born in September. Do you think breeding is when the kid comes out? Is that what you think it is? Do I need to explain sex to you?
Listen, I don't
even
know.
I always breed in the fall. I only have sex in September, and my kids
my
are.
Wife's
they
like,
come out.
Hey,
up
we gotta go to the hospital. I've been pregnant for the past 9 months. Well, another fall, the big one for the old big boy.
The rut strikes again.
My heck, yeah! I didn't know we bred last night.
The big breeder boy comes up again.
I didn't know we were breeding last night. Let's go,
man. My big elk's gonna be proud of me. I think that would be way cool. Here's why I think it's super cool. If we could train our minds as a whole civilization, let's say we got way into that idea. We go, this is only breeding season. I mean, we've talked about this before. When you're not thinking about sex, you go and you're the best version of yourself, whatever that may be, you know?
Yeah. So that's why I think erectile dysfunction should not be cured.
That's exactly right. Like we are the leading advocates for erectile dysfunction.
You'll never see an ED pill like Viagra sponsor this program. I promise you.
No.
We will do the opposite of that. There's a pill that you can take that gives you ED,
the magic pill.
Reach out to
the magic pill.
It's a red pill instead of a blue one.
We're like, you take this. You're the big alpha around, but you can't pursue your business dreams because you can think about is sex. Take our magic pill.
Cool.
Next thing you know, like, you got a successful business. Mm-hmm. You're reading all night. You
that
got a lot of
honestly
stuff.
Honestly, would change society. Don't
of course
you think?
It would. Let's say we had a 3-month window. We say August, September, October. We go, this is rutting season, you know, and you're all in. You get way into it. Okay. But the other 9 months, dude, you flourish. Because you're just like, I don't need to think about that. I don't need to worry about it until it's September. That's just not on my mind. You know?
Take the red pill those 9 months. Take the blue pill the other three.
Right. It's one of two extremes. We're always on pill form. It's a 12-month pill cycle. We can make a ton of money off that.
That's our regime. That's our new thing. All right, take the red pill 9 months. You're gonna be super productive those 9 months. The blue pill months, those three, gonna be super fun, but you're not gonna get anything done.
The totalitarian.
So mark that off the calendar.
It's the totalitarian rule of the beta elk scouts. That's if we rose to power, that's what would occur. We're like, dude, for 9 months, I'm gonna gather so many berries. And we will not want for food during rutting season. It is going to be incredible. It's like our bellies will be filled with berries, and we will be having sex around the clock for 3 months. It's the dream of everyone. That's the rule of us. That's what we would give to the townspeople. Like, that's an incredible thing to have, right? So diving further into rutting season and how it applies to elk. They like the bulls. Again, these are total alphas. Mm-hmm. Like, we could only dream of being.
Listen,
we are so far away from that. We could only dream of it.
Imagine a cow come up to you like, hey, it's time to breed. You're like, I got more berries to
pick. My neck's kind of hurt. Maybe tomorrow night?
Oh boy. Is it that season again?
I'm backed up on berry production. I actually am going to have to dedicate a little more hours at work this week. I mean, next week might be better for me. Like, we're always behind in berry production. It's a big deal.
Why are we getting berries?
That's how you forage for the people. You know, it's just what's available.
How do you get berries with you?
Well, one claws and the other has a bowl and they scoop. Again, I'm the scooper. You're the clar. We've already gone over this.
Yeah, you would be a scooper.
So bowls, the alphas. They just go and they seize control of the situation.
I know. It's
they
so
go
funny.
Gather up. So there's like cows. That's the female elk. And then calves, you know, the children. Mm-hmm. They just go and they dictate who their family is for that season. Mm-hmm. So they can grab like multiple cows. It's like these mm-hmm. polygamists, right? Mm-hmm. So they go in and they whip the entire town into shape. They go, you're with me. You're with me. You're all my kids this year. So they just created a family out of thin air. I would dream of being something like that.
And then us with like our tiny horns, we're like, we'll be close by if you need us.
I know you probably meant to choose us as part of your family, but that's okay.
It's okay to choose us. We'll just be close by. If you need us, we'll be close by. If you don't need us, we'll
move. It's okay. The berry producers, we kind of formed our own family, but if you want to grab us too, that'd be cool. But
we got the berries. Just let us know when you need it. Otherwise, just let us and we'll be fine.
You probably forgot about us because we've been picking berries for so long.
Hey, Bill, thanks so much for not picking us, really.
That's funny you bring that up. I didn't even think about that. But now I'm thinking of the most beta of betas within the whole town. And, like, that would be us. I feel super bad for those because it's the whole concept of picking teams on the playground. And you always get to the end. And the bulls, these big alphas, they go, I want these three sexy cows as my women to mate with this year. And then I want these 10 strong children. And they get down to the end, and it's just me and you, and they're like, are you going to take Chris or, I mean.
Bill, I don't know if you can see. You might want to get a bit closer. I do have horns over here. Can you see it?
So how does the mating work for somebody who's not a bull? Do I get to choose or am I assigned a mate? Like, I have tons of questions for the main person. That's why it'd be so cool, right? It's part of this attraction process. If the cow's, like, not digging it, the bulls will have, like, an attraction off almost, where they go, who's the bigger bull? Who's the cooler bull? And so part of that, they have different things that they go through. It's almost like a beehive games, but for bulls. And the payoff is, like, you get to have sex with somebody, right? So a lot like the beehive games. Yeah, exactly.
The payoff if you lose is...
If you lose, sometimes you die. So again, a lot like the beehive games.
If you win at the beehive games, you do get to have sex with one of us.
Our main event, it's like, you go toe-to-toe with this person in a leg wrestle. If you win, you have sex with me. If you lose, you die. And they don't know what they want.
You would not. That would be
They
the
don't
most...
know what they want. Oh,
I think I'd rather die. I honestly think I'd rather
like,
die
that's such
in
a
that
moral,
situation.
It's such a moral quandary for the person there that they're just like, I don't know what I should choose.
Listen, I've been taking red pills. There's no way I'm having sex.
Listen, it's not the fall. Like, I'm not that into sex right now. Much less the fact that it's you, and I'm just not that into you.
The bowl off, though, is really cool because they lock horns, right? And they're like, ah, oh, she's my cow and all that type of stuff. For us, it would be difficult because you would have no horns. So immediately just like right through the head.
We'd do a side to side, like your shoulder, mine, and we go, like you're jostling for a position because we're like,
I get the extra berry tonight.
Just hitting you with my shoulder.
Everyone else is bashing one another for a mate. I want more berries in my porridge. We're just fighting over who gets the bigger portion of berry porridge.
Imagine us doing a bowl walk.
Everyone else is having a battle to the death. And we're jostling our shoulders for who gets the last berry.
I'd like a little extra nut in mine. Come here, buddy.
Do you know, it actually, as soon as it starts, we're just like, you know what? I'll split the berry. Do you know what? I'll split it with you. I think we both should have part of the berry. We just find amicable ground. And all the cows are watching us. They're just like, that's why I'll never sleep with that guy. I mean, just total betas.
Won't even stand up for a berry.
He can't even make a stand for a blueberry that he picked. What do you think he's going to be like in bed? They look back over, shaking hands. You know, like, you have the whole berry. No, you have the whole berry. We can't even accept the half berry. It's so cool. Dude, as part of the bowl off, you mentioned the antlers. That's the very end. That's like if they can't solve it earlier. Mm-hmm. What's cool is it goes in stages.
Yeah, it's like a duel.
Like they don't immediately go to the death. Yeah. It starts out, they're like, they have a bugle off. So they make the noises. If you have a big time bugle and the other one is just like, that's embarrassing, I'm not that good. Then you've won the cow.
Imagine that.
I'm not even going to try.
Go ahead, Bill. She's yours.
I love thinking about the cows in the situation. Well, because they're all standing there and they're probably talking with one another and they're like, do I go with the bugle guy or the nut? Like, is this really supposed to attract
because he
me?
Was louder? I got to go with him. Oh, he's an a-hole.
The next step after bugling. So let's say they tie on bugling. They go to a tree rub. Like, who can rub most aggressively against a tree? I think that shows the, like, athleticism and sexual power of the body. So you're just like, it's kind of like a striptease that humans do. An elk's doing it, and they're just getting all sensual with, like, a nice pando tree.
The cows are like, I really like that tree.
The cows are like, I used to like that tree. And now I'm watching this, like, weird bull elk grind on it. And then the other one takes its turn with the tree. And I just don't have the love for the tree that I used to, you know?
It's like a pole. Like when you see a pole and it's just by itself, you're not touching that pole.
No, exactly. So they'll do it with shrubs also. And then after that, so let's say they've tied through both the stages, then they go to the third stage, the tie break. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty, as far as social interactions are concerned, that's a pretty damn cool way of like going about your business.
It's interesting. It's set in stone. It's like a law. It's really funny when you tie on the first thing. Like, all right, equal.
Bring in the tree.
The tree rub.
I think it's about equal.
Then
you got to kill the other person.
I would not want to be equal, but he just wins. I don't want to get to this other thing.
If I ever was a bull, I'm just like, I'll throw any engagement as long as I don't have to get to the actual antler off. You know, because if I'm there, I'm dead.
At the bugle, even if I had a better bugle, I'd
I know, exactly.
I would totally dick it
if
up.
I'm anywhere within the level of that person, I'd always make them go first. You probably draw straws or something. I'm like, you go first. If they have a bad one, I go, I know, I can beat them. If they have a good one, I'm just like, brr. Oh, you won. Sorry. Looks like we don't have to get to that stage where one of us dies. That seems pretty good, right?
I don't really want to rub against that tree anyways. Okay.
The last thing I'll say about elk, and then we can move on to the Silicon Slope segment. They have like way cool body language things to like express their displeasure, that kind of stuff. Elk are very expressive creatures. That's also what I like about them. That's why I think they're noble creatures, the more I learn about them. Mm-hmm. They don't just sit there and you go, what's on that elk's mind? Oh, they're like these brooding things. No, they let you know. They'll like get angry, and when they get angry, they just have their things that they do. They curl up their upper lip. Then they grind their teeth. So you curl your upper lip and you grind your teeth, and then you hiss. That's how you show that you're mad.
Yeah, that's what I do.
I
I'm very elk-like.
You are very calf-like. Let's use the correct terms.
That's fine.
You're one of the children, again, the low-level
Great
Barry.
Great job, Dad.
Oh, Dad, you have the best bugle ever. I'm so proud of you. You're my dad.
I can tell you're mad at me because you're sneering at me, but I'm still proud of you, Dad.
The bowl, it's like, you are older than me. I don't know how you came to be a part of my posse, and I don't know why you keep calling me Dad. I didn't choose you as part of this year's Rutt family. You know, this Rutt family doesn't include you. You got to stop coming into the hut with everybody at night and acting like you were chosen.
Dad, you're so... My dad's the best tree rubber in the whole wide world.
You're like on your deathbed, like this 100-year-old elk just talking to all these young elk and calling them your dad.
Dad, I love you so much. You've shown me so much love throughout life.
These are great creatures.
Elk are great.
This is the first state symbol or state creature, whatever you want to call them, that I've come across that I think is perfect. Mm-hmm. I don't think we change a thing about the Rocky Mountain elk as our state creature. I actually think we lean into it harder. I think there's so many things we could do with the elk. I think it should be on our state flag. It should be the only thing. I'm out on the bees now. I'm out on the beehive. Sorry, no offense to our own organization.
Screw the beehive.
I think
we're now the elk.
We're now the rut. We should be called the rut.
We're the rut. The rutters.
It's a big tree. Like simulating a stripper pole, but it's you and I with like a big family around us that we chose for that season.
And berries everywhere, dude. That's the flag.
That's cool.
So Rocky Mountain Elk, stamp of approval is the state creature.
I love the Rocky Mountain Elk. That's cool. All right, we're going to go to Seal Consults where we talk to Franklin Covey's Paul Walker. Franklin Covey. You think like, oh, Franklin Covey, big company in the 90s with their planners and stuff. Still an enormous company. They've pivoted. They're amazing. So we're talking to Franklin Covey's Paul Walker, but first, quick word from our sponsor, Chatbooks.
I used to be a busy mom. Now I'm a homeschooling, hand sanitizing, mask applying, social distancing busy mom. I was so bored before. The last thing I need is the added stress of printing family photos. Fortunately, I use Chatbooks, the app that automatically turns my Instagram photos into adorable photo books. Think about all those photos you've already posted to your Instagram account. That's a whole collection of Chatbooks waiting to happen. Just connect to your account, review, and order. Holy sweet Meghan Markle, it worked! Chatbooks. Live your life and let Chatbooks print it one $10 book at a time.
Welcome to Silicon Slopes Live. Today we're joined by Paul Walker, who is the president and COO of Franklin Covey. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Thank you for coming. Appreciate you taking the time. So if I was to ask a 60-year-old, what is Franklin Covey and what do they do, versus ask a 20-year-old, what is Franklin Covey?
What would they say?
Yep. What's the difference?
I think if a 60-year-old would say, wow, I love your company. I used to use one of your planners. In fact, I'd go to the store every year in the mall and get my refill for the planner. Or they might say, you know, The 7 Habits, that book changed my life, either professionally or personally. A 20-year-old, and we're making sure we work to change this, but a 20-year-old might say, Franklin Covey, I think I've heard of them. Or they might say, you know, I read the book, The 7 Habits, as part of one of my college classes, but I don't really know what you guys do.
And so that's why you're here today, to talk about that a little bit.
Yeah.
So what is Franklin Covey in 2021?
What's the official answer for the 20-year-olds today? Yeah, so Franklin Covey, if I were to say it just briefly, we're still in a lot of ways in the same business we were in. If you think about it, back in the day when we were the 7 Habits or the Planner people, what we were trying to do fundamentally was help individuals and organizations build habits of effectiveness that would guide them throughout their career and throughout their life. And the manifestation of that, the way that got applied, for example, in the planner business, what we were really doing, we sold a lot of planners, but we were trying to teach people the skills of productivity and how to prioritize their life, how to stay focused on the things that are most important. And then the planner became the tool to do that back before we had Microsoft Outlook and before everybody carried smartphones around. And of course, that's no longer relevant, but we still do a lot of work today helping individuals and organizations, for example, learn and put into practice those skills of managing their time and their energy around the things that are most important. But the company today, we're in the performance improvement space organizationally. So we help organizations really do one of three things. We help at the organizational level, help organizations execute strategies, particularly where those strategies require human beings to do something different. Example would be Marriott Hotels. They want to improve guest satisfaction. We go in and we partner and we work with their employees across the world on the behaviors that they need to be doing more consistently that would be connected to guest sat. Do the same thing in the sales space on those sales behaviors. We do a lot of work in leadership development. And that's something we'll talk about here today, I'm sure. And then, you know, kind of core to our company, what we do is help organizations with their culture. And we believe culture is what the vast majority of people do and the way they behave the vast majority of the time. And so we're working on those individual effectiveness behaviors and how those tie into the overall company culture. So organizational performance improvement is really what the company is today. No longer stores or planners.
Yeah, I still see those, though.
You do. In fact, there's actually planners are having a bit of a resurgence. Yeah. And the Franklin Planner, you can still buy it. There's a company that owns that and has licensed that brand from us. And,
oh,
yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, but the actual core company is not in that business anymore.
Gotcha. So you talked about those three things, and then you mentioned Marriott, but break it down a little bit more. So these are products and solutions, right?
Yeah.
So I guess the difference between when Marriott calls you and says, hey, we need some help on improving customer experience versus like calling McKinsey or Bain or a consulting group. What's the difference there? Yeah. And then how does that product get sold and onboarded and traded on?
Great question. So unlike a consulting firm, you know, we don't consult. We're not coming in what we focus on and where we're focused with organizations that we work with is we have kind of six or seven core areas that we help an organization. We think that these are the areas that they're kind of the thorniest people related areas. Challenges around how do you get everybody in an organization lined up and moving in a common direction, right? That's a difficult thing to do. How do you lead an organization through a great period of change? That's a difficult thing to do. And we bring our thought leadership. Sometimes we bring thought leadership in from outside experts. We codify that into a training program. And then we roll that out either for our organizations or we certify people inside their organizations to do that. Increasingly, it's very technology enabled. It used to be you'd go away for a day or two or three to a hotel ballroom and sit through training, right? That was the way the 60-year-olds did it. Now it's very much just in time. It's very technical. It's live. It's live online. It's self-paced. We deliver everything on a technology platform that supports multiple learning modalities. But at our core, we're delivering learning to individuals on topics that are connected directly to organizational performance.
That makes sense. Great answer. So a prospective client will visit the website and see the various products and services, and it sounds like they're very flexible in what they get to choose. And once they've chosen it, they can roll it out in all sorts of varieties.
Yeah, they might visit our website. We have just under 300 salespeople that are out there calling on clients all the time as well around the world. We're a very, very global company. So we operate in more than 140 countries through a combination of offices that we own and operate ourselves and then a licensee or a franchisee network. And so our salespeople are out there calling on organizations as well. And depending on who we're selling to, we sell to learning and development folks. But we also sell to a lot of chief executives and executive teams. And their needs are different. And so the solution that we might propose to them is different depending on, you know, the different types of buyers that we're selling to as well and what they're trying to accomplish.
Yeah. So, you know, possible sales in the works, you've got your client on the line and they're obviously going to ask questions, right? And then you're also going to ask questions to verify the best fits. How does that go to kind of customize the products for them? I assume it's a lot of listening. Mm-hmm. Did like folks go and interact with them face to face and get like a day in the life of this executive? How deep do you guys go to decide on what or products to offer?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we actually, one of the things that we do, one of the offerings we have for our clients is a sales methodology. It's called helping clients succeed. And our premise, in fact, we call our salespeople client partners for a reason. Yes, we want to make a sale, absolutely, but we are very interested in becoming a partner with that client, you know, metaphorically trying to get on the same side of the table as them. And so the way that we sell and engage is through a lot of questioning, trying to diagnose always before we prescribe, to understand. Oftentimes we find that clients will come to us and they think they know what they want, but interestingly enough, they're not exactly sure why they want it, right? And so a good salesperson will help distill down and kind of peel that onion until there's shared clarity on, yeah, we could help train your leaders, but to what end, right? What metric are you trying to move, or what are you trying to accomplish? If you had perfect leaders, what would that allow you to do that tomorrow that you can't do today? And it's once we understand that, we know exactly which solution to prescribe. And then we both know what will it look like when we're successful. And for us, that's a big deal. We need to be able to come back and demonstrate, whether it's 6 months or 12 months or however long later, look back and say, hey, did we accomplish with you the thing that you were trying to accomplish? Did we move the metrics that you wanted to move?
Yeah. So I imagine some of these folks, when they reach out to you, they're fairly miserable, right? They can't nail down the leadership, or they can't nail down the scaling. They're reaching out because you guys have solutions, right?
Yeah.
And they have a problem. And so oftentimes, at least when I'm in that situation, I don't really want to talk about it anymore. Can you just do it? But that's not the answer, right? They're going to have to bite the bullet and go through all of their problems and details to find the right solution.
Yeah, it's a great point. I sold for the company for 6 or 7 years earlier in my career. I've been with the company a long time. And I got burned a couple of times where I ate that marshmallow too quickly and didn't push through past, you know, yeah, we could just come do something for you, but it's going to be more beneficial to you and to me if we can get vision lock on. Let's just spend a little more time here and get clear on exactly what we're trying to accomplish. You know, it's 7 habits. Begin with the end in mind. What is the end that we're trying to accomplish here? And I think the best salespeople do that really well. They don't overdo it. Right, you don't want to take somebody and just drag them through a process for the sake of doing it, but there is a point you need to get to there.
Yeah, and so you talked about, you know, success, 6 months, 12 months. I assume you've got clients that are long-time clients, and then, you know, certain campaigns or whatever have results, and, you know, you've never had better tools to track all that and keep tabs on that. But what are some of the interesting, you know, I have to mention names, but like case studies of some cool, from problem to endpoint, what were some cool data points and results that were achieved, and how were they achieved?
Yeah. So as I answer that, to the metrics point, one of the transformations that has happened at Franklin Covey over the last 5 years is we've moved into, we're a subscription company and increasingly a SaaS company. And so we used to engage with a client where we would just identify that one problem they had, and we would bring that one solution we had to that one problem. But in the process of trying to identify that one problem, we'd uncover 7 different things they were dealing with. And we had all these other solutions that could have helped with the other 6 as well. And so we decided one day, about 5 years ago, let's just engage with a client and provide them access to everything we have via a subscription. And then we really are on the same side of the table as them. And now they're an owner of the content effectively, and we can just help them consume as much of that as they would like to consume. And we deliver that all on a technology platform today. And so in that, we have very high logo retention rate. Our revenue retention is extremely high. It's up right near 100%. So our clients stay with us from year to year. Which is great. To your specific question about just, you know, some interesting case studies, without mentioning, I mentioned Marriott earlier. They've been a great client for a long time. That's one we can talk about. But we have a client right now, very large telecommunications company that just merged with another large telecommunications company. They're in the mobile wireless space. And they've been a client of ours for a while, but they have just significantly increased what they're doing with us because they're merging these two companies. The two cell phone providers are merging. Probably guess who they are. And they recognize that they need to create a common culture quickly if this merger is going to be successful in a fast way. And so we have a whole set of content around trust and how do you build trust and and get that into the whole, you know, fabric of your culture. And so they're using our trust content. It's called The Speed of Trust. Stephen Covey's son, Stephen M. R. Covey, wrote a book a few years ago about The Speed of Trust. And they're using that content, and they're taking it to 75,000 employees over the next year and a half or so as they establish this new culture in the two integrated companies. So that's just an example of the kind of work that we engage with our clients.
That's a great example. And about a year and a half, year ago, maybe 9 months, 9 months to a year, somebody from one of those companies had a shirt on with a yellow logo.
Yeah.
And was talking about what the pink logo's phone options were. I'm a customer of the pink logo, but he was a door-to-door sales bro. And I was outside playing in the back. My wife answered the door, and she's like, hey, there's a kid out here. And I'm like, oh, he's selling pest control or something. The pricing on his little tablet was different than the pricing that I already had, and he didn't know that I had a discount, like a special account. I'm like, well, so who do you work for exactly? And it wasn't his fault, right? Like, it was fresh. He's like, well, it's merging and all of this. So I get why they've hired you.
Well, and you think about an example like that. For an organization to pull off the technical side of that integration, you've got to get to a point where people who saw themselves as competitors not that long ago to come together and get a shared vision pretty quickly. And that requires individuals who aren't even leaders to get there, but it also requires, think of the behaviors those leaders have to bring to bear. I mean, so there's definitely a human dynamic to this, and the way people lead, the way they engage each other, the type of culture that gets created, and that's what Franklin Covey does today. And some of that's through training, some of it's through assessments, some of it's through coaching, number of different ways to get that job done. But at the center of that all is really some great content that causes you to rethink, rewire your brain a bit, and then introduces some new behaviors and some tools that you can use to support that shift.
Yeah, if you don't have process tools, services like you, it is a nightmare, I would assume. And some interesting ones, like the baby bells, one of them turned out to be Verizon.
Yeah.
And then as Verizon was competing with the rest, they started acquiring their competitors. And with each one, they had to go through this.
Yeah.
And they were doing big acquisitions year over year. And I think they rebranded as Verizon in 2000 or 2001. And then it was easier. But for them, I can't imagine the constant struggles.
It may be applicable to this, to Silicon Slopes. Is the inverse of that is the company that starts small, very genius founder, and has rapid growth and all of a sudden has to bring in lots of new people to fill roles that you didn't need in the early days, but now you need them as you have a maturing customer base. It's the same type of challenge. How do you integrate those new employees? How do you make sure that as a leader, you're able to communicate? We wouldn't presume to think that we would know anything about your strategy, but when it comes to how do you communicate that, how do you get people bought in when you do have to make a big shift or a change? That's difficult for an organization. And how do you do that in the most effective way so you don't lose days or weeks or months of productivity as people try to grapple with, why are we doing this? It's a never-ending, changing business environment you're in, whether you're Verizon or whether you're the young startup.
Yeah, you're right. The young startup growing and scaling is much more applicable, and that's why you guys have like a pretty big tool chest of tools and options. All the way from the grumpy, old, stodgy CEO to the to the younger one, and everything in between. And so you guys have to stay sharp and evolve your products and your solution offerings to the market. And it changes a lot faster than it used to, I get the impression.
It does. In fact, in the last few years, last decade or so, we've spent more than $120 million on product development, making sure that the legacy, we don't want to lose our heritage. I mean, the Seven Habits, the Seven Habits is selling more books today. It's in its 30th year than it did in what you might have thought of was the heyday. I mean, this is just been a juggernaut. And so we're on the fourth, soon to be the fifth version of the training version of how you implement Seven Habits inside an organization to create common language and common ways of working. And so, that product development's directed towards keeping those legacy blockbusters going, the new content on new topics we want to bring to market, and then increasingly a significant portion of that's going into technology. As I mentioned earlier, we don't come and sit in a room like this, and that's just not the way it is anymore, or it certainly won't be the way it is in the future. And so how do you deliver that technology to people on their phones, in the seams of their work day, And so a lot of it does require a lot of investment and ongoing investment.
Yeah, and kudos to you and your team to keep making those adaptations over the year. And you're pretty lucky to have that anchor of a best-selling book for 35 years that you can always reference. Cool. So you are kind of a outlier in that you've been with the same company, Franklin Covey, for your entire career.
Yeah, it'll be 21 years in October.
21 years. That doesn't happen a lot anymore in this day and age. Was that by design? And if not, just give us a quick rundown of how you've progressed to your current role as president and CEO.
Yeah, so COO.
COO.
You know, and so not by design, at least not in the early part. I was fortunate. I grew up in Seattle. Actually came to Utah. I played golf and on a golf scholarship to BYU. And for a brief moment in my life, I thought maybe that's what I would do. Clearly, it didn't turn out that way. You didn't see me on the Masters, playing in the Masters this last weekend. But came out of school and had the good fortune to get linked up with Franklin Covey and started out in an inside sales role. Wasn't really sure what I wanted to do. I had a degree and started out there. After a year of that, became a salesperson, became a client partner, did that for 6 or 7 years. And we actually moved to Chicago. So I spent 15 of my almost 21 years in Chicago with my family out there and moved up into some different management roles. And then we moved back to Salt Lake City. I live in Draper, but we moved back here 5 and a half, almost 6 years ago. And I've had a few different roles between then and now. But I would say about halfway into my time at the company, I started to think this, I knew it was a special place, but I realized this is a place I'd like to stay for the rest of my career. It's a really unique place. The culture is fantastic. The people are wonderful. The content you're around, you kind of live in the soup every day of this great content. And it impacts your life professionally, but personally, I'm a different dad and a different husband, I'm sure, because of being around what we do all the time. So I would say it was totally by accident. And then, you know, it's by accident I'm in the role I'm in right now, right? Right place, right time. But I love it, and I hope to stay here a long time.
Yeah, that's awesome, because you're still young, so you may end up with like 35, 40 years, theoretically.
Yeah. People in the company probably don't want that. But.
And my guess is there wasn't a lot of luck in ending up where you are. Real quick deviation. If you've played it can't be on your bucket list, but if you could play one course one time in all of God's green earth, which one would it be?
Well, I'd probably say Augusta. I've played a lot of great courses, but that one is tough to play. A lot of them you can get on. That one I don't have my connection yet. In fact, there might be somebody inside the Silicon Slopes world has a connection there. I'd love to talk to you.
We are going to enter into a partnership with Franklin Covey. Silicon Slopes and Franklin Covey are going to have some cool leadership training development content out there. TBD on the name and the button of what it'll be on our website. But talk a little bit about what kind of content will be on with this partnership and who would it really cater to.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Thanks. Well, and really thank you to the organization for inviting us to participate. We're honored. We're very grateful. I think the idea is Silicon Slopes, just looking at all the different services you provide to your constituents now and looking for, you know, how to expand that and add the most value possible. This idea was born of, hey, we could help together provide a leadership development opportunity for leaders inside many organizations in the area here. And so we're excited to do that. We know a thing or two about that. That's kind of our sweet spot as an organization. And so, you know, there are a number of things we do at Franklin Covey. We help organizations around building the kind of culture they want to build. We help them with sales performance related things. We actually train a lot of sales forces. We help them with strategy execution. We work in leadership development. We work on individual effectiveness skills. This particular content we're going to bring to this, we have two offerings, one called the 6 Critical Practices to Leading a Team, and the other is Unconscious Bias. And so 6 Critical Practices, very practical. How do I engage my team set the right kind of vision. First, how do I adopt the right mindset as a leader? And then some practical skills for how do I hold one-on-ones more effectively? How do I engage my team most effectively? How do I set that vision? How do we deal with change? And so we'll march through that content over time as part of this process. The other is a program that's new to us. We've actually had it for about a year and a half now, an unconscious bias. And it's really focused on how do we create the right, we want to create a great culture. How do I as a leader and how do we as individuals in the organization look past the things that on the surface might cause us to think we're different and get past all of that? And, you know, our brains are wired. We have biases all the time, and some of those are not very effective or helpful. And this course helps really examine those and get to a much more productive way in the way that we engage people. So those are a couple that we're going to bake into this process, and we're just again grateful to be a partner in this, and hope it'll be valuable to those of you that want to participate.
Yeah, absolutely, and we're excited as well, and we're lucky that we have a preeminent leader in this industry that's just in our backyard, and both of those content pieces are very applicable to our audience, and they'll find a ton of value out of that. So this will be fun, and we'll iterate as needed and try to provide as much value and service going forward. So thank you so much, Paul. Appreciate your time being here. Look forward to Franklin Covey's continued success.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me. This has been great.
That was Paul Walker from Franklin Covey and GC, as we call him around the office, Garrett Clark, doing the interview. Watch the full thing. Silicon Slopes has its own channel on the Beehive, siliconslopes.tv. Make sure you check it out. And now, No Baller.
Conventional wisdom is not eternal. This is something that I think about a lot, whether that's just in life in general, or whether that applies to the area that I'm most passionate about, which is sports. The idea that because something is true in present day doesn't mean that that will always be so, right? And I see that manifested on a daily basis in a million different ways, right? And me, I skew more onto the skeptic side of, well, why do we think that? And what's going on there? Obviously, you and I have created another segment called Why Though, based simply upon that exploration in the mind of, this is something we all think is true and we don't, or we take it without a grain of salt. And why is that? That's kind of interesting. Let's talk about that. And, you know, sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's kind of a bleak truth that we learn about society or ourselves. And we go, oh, maybe that should be a little bit different. So I'm exploring sports stuff constantly, as everybody who listens to this segment knows. And the other day I come across a tweet from Tom Haberstroh, who's an NBA writer that I really like. And within the tweet, he's talking about the pace and space era in present day. And he says, the 2005 Suns led the NBA in 15.2 pick and roll points per game, 24.7 3-point attempts per game, and 95.9 possessions per 48 minutes. Those same marks would rank last in all three categories in today's NBA. So that's the end of the tweet. And that is the starting point for this discussion about conventional wisdom and how it applies to the NBA. Back in 2005, Mike D'Antoni had taken over the Phoenix Suns a couple years prior, and they had kind of instituted this new style of basketball built around pace and space, right? They wanted to play at a faster pace, as manifested by leading the league in possessions per 48 minutes. And they wanted to play with space, as manifested by constant stream of pick and rolls relative to the rest of the league and three-point attempts relative to the rest of the league. And that's how you create pace, and that's how you create space. You get two talented players in a pick and roll. For them, it was Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire. You surround them with shooting. That's where the space comes from, because it stresses a defense, and they have to guard the entire floor, right? So at the time, teams didn't play like this. We were coming out of, well, we were still in kind of the isolation era for perimeter players, whether that was the Michael Jordan or the Kobe style of basketball, where you had a really good wing scorer and you said, give me the ball and I'm going to go and create offense this way. Or it was still part of the big man, dump it into the post style era, whether that was Shaq or Tim Duncan or these really talented bigs. They said, get me on the block, throw me the ball, and I'm going to manufacture offense through these two ways. And that's how the NBA was, especially throughout the 90s and into the early 2000s. That was the way you won, because of those players that I just mentioned. They popularized that style. Their teams built systems around them to maximize their impact through the way that they played basketball, and that's how you won a title. And that's just what we thought of basketball. We thought you need a really good wing isolation scorer. You need a really good big guy. That's how you win in the NBA. That's the conventional wisdom at the time. So Mike D'Antoni and the Phoenix Suns come into that. They acquire Steve Nash from the Dallas Mavericks, who was this smaller point guard. And Mike D'Antoni leaned into pace and space. He looked at the league and he said, I think there's an opportunity for us to play a different style of basketball and maybe really take teams by surprise and maximize the talents of our roster, and we can win in that manner, right? And if you followed basketball back at the time, as the Phoenix Suns got good really into this window, you know, like the 2005 to 2010-ish range, the conventional wisdom at the time was to make fun of their style of basketball, to say, this is cool and it's fun to watch, but that's what it is. It's fun. It's not a winning brand of basketball. That was the moniker that was attached to the Suns and to that pace and space style at the time. It was, this is fun, this is entertaining, but it's more of it's side entertainment, you know? It's a little bit of a clown show. You guys don't play defense. You don't really care about that as much. You're shooting all these threes. Like, we don't really understand this basketball in the context of how basketball is played at the highest level at the time, right? So they go through a wide variety of failures on the brightest stages. You know, 2005, they're a 62-win team, which, for those of you who don't know, very, very, very good regular season record, you know. They end up losing to the Spurs in the conference finals that year. The Spurs go on to beat the Pistons and win. And that was a moment that everybody pointed to. They said, 62-20 in the regular season, that's a great record. You're not built for the playoffs. You can't win with that style. The Spurs, they throw it to Tim Duncan. They grind you into a nub. They beat you. They beat the Pistons in the finals. That's how you win. You guys can't win like this. You know, you go on to the next year, 54-win team. They make the conference finals again. They lose in this great shootout against the Mavericks in the conference finals. Nowitzki and Nash memorably have this back and forth going. It's a really entertaining series, but it was another thing where people went, you can't win with this style, you know? 2007 is probably the most notable moment of that era for Mike D'Antoni and the Suns, which is they won 61 games. Again, 60-plus wins, an incredible regular season. They lose to the Spurs in the conference semis. It was a 4-2 series. For those of you that remember, the Suns have home court advantage in that series. They're down 2-1. Game 4 is on the road in San Antonio. The Suns are running away with it to tie it up, to go back home for Game 5 in Phoenix, where they have home court. And Robert Horry, who plays for the Spurs, he hip-checks Steve Nash into the scorer's table right at the end of the game. And it turns into this kind of little mini melee. And a couple players on Phoenix's bench, they run onto the court. They don't do anything. They just run out there because that's their guy, and they're angry about it. And then the coaches pull them back, and they go, no, 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 you can't do that. That's, you know, by the letter of the law, the NBA will suspend you if you take a step onto the court during an on-court altercation if you are not one of the players that's currently in the game, right? And so they take literally a step in. Amari Stoudemire, one of their very best players, and Boris Diaw, one of their very best players. And the NBA goes letter of the law on them, and they say, nope, you guys aren't going to play in Game 5. And so, like, it's one of the great what-ifs that exist in NBA history. This team, the very best team of that era, in my opinion, for the Phoenix Suns individually, they end up losing that game. They lose in 6 to the Spurs, and it's the great what-if of, like, well, this seemed like it was their very best chance at a title and their best team. They didn't have two of their 3 or 4 best players, depending on what you think of Diaw, and now they don't have a title, right? So we kind of just push them to the side. They're one of the great lost teams in NBA history, you know, like the 2002 Sacramento Kings, these teams that were so good in the moment that everybody went, wow, this is really fun and kind of a different style, but you ultimately fell short through a lot of stuff that maybe you couldn't necessarily control. And because of that, we attach the title to you of, you're not a winner as a team, and you also did not play a winning brand of basketball, okay? So I come across another tweet that had a graph on it. It's from Henry Abbott, you know, True Hoop, right? And for those of you who are watching this, you can see the graph on the screen. For those of you who are listening, I'll explain a little bit of what this is, okay? So it's 25 years of NBA jumpers. It's a bar chart, right? And it goes over the course of the last 25 years in the NBA, and it says, this is the amount of jumpers, so long twos and three-pointers, that are shot in the NBA on average per team, right? The actual percentage of those things. And it's actually surprisingly stationary, the combination of those two things, right? So if you look into the 2005 season, you have, you know, roughly a little bit below 45% of people's field goal attempts were either long twos or threes, right? And then you look into present day in 2021, it's right around that same percentage is a combination of those two things, which I found to be very interesting. I would think that that wouldn't match up. However, where the interest really, really, really comes about, the actual amount of three-pointers that are shot relative to the amount of two-pointers, back in 2005, this pace and space era, it's kind of a 50-50 split, you know, 20-some-odd percent three, 20-some-odd percent long twos. You fast forward into present day, and you have less than 10% of your field goal attempts are now long twos. And all the rest of that 45% window, you know, your remaining 35% of your field goal attempts, that's three-pointers, right? So I'm going to go back to what I was talking about, that conventional wisdom stuff. In 2005 and that whole era, we talked about that style of play, pace and space. We said, this isn't winning basketball. You just can't win like this. It's gimmicky. It's built around offense. You don't win with offense. You win with some offense, but ultimately you got to play defense and you can't really win like this. And people poked fun at the Suns and they said, this is dumb. And Mike D'Antoni, you're kind of an idiot for doing this because this is not a winning style of basketball. We all held that belief. Like, I personally held that belief. I really enjoyed watching the Spurs at the time. And anytime they went against the Suns, a team that I did enjoy watch playing, part of the thing that I would always talk about with my friends when we're discussing, you know, like, who do you think is going to win? How do you think this is going to work from a matchup perspective? One of the things that I personally would say at the time was I was just like, the style of play that they win is not conducive, or the style of play that they bring to the table in the playoffs is not conducive to winning, especially against a team like the Spurs, who play the exact style of play that is conducive to winning in basketball. That's just how it is, and that's how it's going to be. That's the NBA, right? So you fast forward, Mike D'Antoni, he doesn't ever win a title. He's without a title. He has a very noticeable or a very major loss on his record again in 2018 as head coach of the Rockets, 65 win team, best regular season record. The incredible flame out in game 7 of the Western Conference Finals against the Warriors when they missed 27 straight threes. The incredible bad break that they have where Chris Paul pulls his hamstring at the end of game 5 and they're up 3-2 in that series and they don't have him for the next two games. Again, part on the team, part just random chance, fate, whatever you want to call it, just breaks, luck, all of those things go into that. So he's still without title. He's now strangely enough, he's an assistant coach for Steve Nash, who coaches the Brooklyn Nets, who, if you pay attention to Vegas odds, are the favorite to win the East in present day and are, alongside the Lakers, one of the co-favorites to win the NBA title, right? And where I find this whole discussion to be both fascinating and frustrating, and again, I'm part of this crowd. Like, this is something that I see in myself in the past, and I try to correct course in present day. Because now, over the last 5 years, as pace and space has exploded, again, that bar chart illustrates perfectly what is going on in the NBA. It's about getting into pick and rolls. It's about shooting a high volume of threes, and it's about creating the space. The Jazz are doing that to absolute perfection throughout the course of this regular season. Conventional wisdom in present day and over the last 5 years, as soon as the Golden State Warriors won a title, who also perfected this style of basketball, conventional wisdom is now you can only win with pace and space. You can only win with high volume three-point attempts, right? Which is a direct contradiction to how we thought 15 years ago. So I look at that in present day and I go, there are parts of this that seem like they will always exist. Like the mathematical or the simple mathematics of 3 points is more than 2 points. And if we can get more of those shots at a high quality, we're going to average more points per possession than the other team that maybe isn't doing that. That's simple math. That seems like something that will stick. And yet at the same time, I try to look at things both within the NBA and within other sports leagues. And I go, what are things that we currently hold as like this rock solid truth that this is how you build a team and this is the only way to success? What are ways that we look at right now that are going to be really different in maybe 5 years, maybe 10 years, maybe 15 years? What are some of those things? If you follow the life cycle of sports, they're exactly that. They're cycles. They ebb and they flow. Actually, maybe a cycle is not even the correct term. It's more of a roller coaster, you know? There are certain things that happen. There's the ebb and there's the flow. And when you're in the moment, and especially because when you're living 5 years, 5 years is a very long time. When you're living it as a fan or as a manager of a team or a player, that kind of stuff, it seems like that's just how it will always be. You know, I fall into that same rut as myself as a fan. I go, man, we're just shooting a bunch of threes and running a bunch of pick and rolls. It seems like that's where basketball's headed and that's what's always going to happen. Maybe it is, maybe it isn't. It's really hard to say. more times than not, history shows us that like there will be something drastically different about all of the leagues and the way that they are built. There will be something drastically different in a decade from now that we can't actually foresee. And part of what makes that whole process so cool and like makes people like Mike D'Antoni stand out is like who is able to identify stuff like that pre-curve? Who is able to start doing the thing that no one else is doing and usually most times will get ridiculed for? And the next thing you go or the next thing you know, you go, wow, like that's kind of weird. But Mike D'Antoni in his own way was actually kind of a visionary for why basketball was headed. Granted, he never won a championship with it. But that didn't mean that that style of basketball can't win. And in fact, now we're sitting in an era where that style of basketball is absolutely the way to win. So the last thing I'm going to say on this subject is part of that bar graph tweet that Henry Abbott put out. He had a quote from D'Antoni where he says, sure, it gives you a little satisfaction. So he's referring to like they're talking about you're kind of like the grandfather of basketball, present day basketball. You ushered in this era. You're one of the main leading figures with that. And so he has a quote about that where he goes, sure, it gives you a little satisfaction, but I'll tell you what, I'd trade that satisfaction for a championship, end quote. So that also, like, this is me reading between the lines a little bit on that quote, but it bums me out a little bit because there's such stress and importance placed upon just the simple fact of you either have won a championship or you have not. And we categorize all of a person's accomplishments within the world of sports based upon that simple thing. We'll go back and rewrite history based upon those things. At the start of this week, I started by talking about Hideki Matsuyama winning the Masters, who was always seen as this kind of like, he hasn't maximized his talent. He's a little bit of a loser and he's never won the big tournament. And he wins the Masters over the weekend. And as soon as that happened, like every podcast I listen to, every article that's written, it's a celebration of all of the things in the past that we ridiculed him for, right? Which I'm a big person of, you got to celebrate the person in the moment and you got to go, if this thing is cool or if this thing is good, like enjoy that as a fan. And don't go back after the fact 5 years down the road and go, Hideki Matsuyama won the Masters and now that was actually cool when he went through this spell in 2014 to 2017 and he won some PGA Tour events, but maybe didn't win a major, right? So I read this quote from Mike D'Antoni and like, I'm a person in my own life, and this comes from getting really into golf and playing competitive golf at an amateur level. Like, you get so into the grind of things and you get so concerned about worrying about the ultimate prize, which is like, I want to win, I want to win, I want to win, I want to win. And it's really hard to like not be ground into a nub by that simple thing, the pressure that you place on yourself and just entering into tournaments and having that pressure by virtue of I paid $100 and I'm trying to win this and oh no, what's going on and this kind of that. I got to the point where it's like, okay, I have to be more in tune with the actual things that I love about this journey. And indeed the journey itself, a lot of the times that's a life philosophy that I abide by. And I had to apply it to golf, which is the end payoff is never what you think it will be. And a lot of times it never manifests itself, especially at the very highest level. Like there's a pretty good chance I go my entire amateur golf career and don't win a tournament because I started late and I'm not as talented as a lot of people who play amateur golf. Simple fact, right? And so because of that, like I can't sit there and go, I have to win. And if I don't, this is all something that I'll look back on in like a sad manner or a frustrated manner. I have to embrace those things that like drive me into this game that I find immense joy out of. And so maybe that's something as simple as, I'm going to go out and play today in the rain. And if I shoot an 82, I shoot an 82. At the same time, I enjoyed myself. I talked about sports or whatever with my friends. And that's the way that I'm able to kind of maximize the journey. If it pays off in that ultimate goal, that's great. I'll do, you know, cartwheels down the road if that happens. But I can't like get so fixated on that's the only thing that I think about and care about and talk about. And like, I say that as a life philosophy for an amateur person, and we don't really, and I think everybody who would listen to what I'm saying right now goes, okay, I agree with that. And like, that is a healthier way of trying to go about your day to day and like trying to keep yourself emotionally and mentally stable as a person who wants to be a competitor, but also wants to enjoy the thing that they're doing. And we don't really ever apply that at a professional level. We always will go, well, if you haven't won a championship, like you should look back on your career with consternation and anger because you never obtained the ultimate prize. So I see that quote from D'Antoni. And on the one hand, I go, yeah, like I get it. Everybody wants to win and everybody's competitive and that's cool. I'm sure that a lot of people would want a championship, especially all the people who don't have one. At the same time, it bums me out a little bit when I hear like, yeah, it gives me a little satisfaction, but like ultimately I just trade all this for a championship, because I look at it and I go, what you've actually like done and ushered in is like really, really, really incredible and cool. You know, like you actually are a visionary, and that's not a word that I use very often with people in sports. Like, you identified where basketball was headed 15 years prior. You tried to institute that way of playing and you didn't win with it, but you were like the person who understood that before anybody else at a coaching level. And now we are there. And to hear like, I just wish that I had a championship. I'm like, I get that. At the same time, this is like something you should celebrate if you're Mike D'Antoni. This is something you should be proud of and say, you know what? This is really cool that I was able to identify this. And hopefully we can win a championship this year on the Nets. And if I do, I'm going to be super happy about it. At the same time, like, conventional wisdom was what it was in 2005. I was able to identify clearly and coherently that that is not always going to be the case. What are different avenues? And I identified the clearest and most coherent way to win 15 years later. And that's something to hang my hat on and to celebrate. So that's today's No Baller segment, something to think about for the weekend. And for all of you who like sports and just like enjoy watching stuff, I always want people to like think about things like this. You know, I hate how we always get sucked into, did you win? Did you lose? Okay, that's all that we're going to talk about. Everything is contextualized by those things. I think there's so many cool things that go into the journey of being a sports fan that like I really like to talk about and celebrate, including this entire segment. And so I just like, I want people to view sports through a similar prism and just think about things like this when they're watching games.
And now, dear Clint, but first, a quick word from our sponsor, Rags. Not forget to go to DearClint.com. We have a weekly newsletter that comes out. That's DearClint.com. The most recent one was published. Go check it out. Make sure you subscribe. Very important to do so. There you can actually win some prizes from the Beehive Store.
Oh, baby.
Yeah, which is really cool. Here's how you reach out to us. Put that up again. It's DearClint@TheBeehive.com. You can send us an email. You can call us and leave us a voicemail at that number. You can text us at that number, and you hit us up on social media at TheBeehiveHQ at hashtag DearClint. Here's today's Dear Clint. Starts like this. Dear Dad, I'm not growing as fast as I'd like. I know I need to be tall to play for the Utah Jazz, but what will I do with my life if I don't make the NBA? This is from my son, Ollie. That is a real question that he has. Like, my son, Oliver, his dream, as most kids are at his age, he's about, I don't know how old Ollie is, actually, 9, 10?
He's 15, a young lad. He's 20.
6?
He might be 20.
38? How old is
I just saw you asked Weston and Kelly, and they're like looking on their computers. They start typing in. They're all Oliver.
How old is Oliver
Betts? Let's see here.
So Ollie, he's at the age where he's playing junior jazz. Actually, like coached his team. He's really into basketball. His room is decorated jazz stuff. He just loves. His favorite player of all time is Donovan Mitchell. He thinks Donovan Mitchell's the greatest player of all time. Like, no one's better than Donovan Mitchell. And you can't even. There's no thing. There's nothing you can convince him otherwise that Donovan Mitchell may not be the best player in the NBA right now. He's just like, no, he's the very best. He's amazing. We go to the Jazz game. He's rooting for him, screaming every time he does anything. Even when he misses, he's like, he would have made that if X, right? Like, he's all in. I love it.
That's
the perfect
cool.
age. It's the perfect age for a kid and for a sports fan. Like, he's going to, you know, you remember being a kid. Like, you're going to have his player from now until forever is going to be Donovan Mitchell. That's really cool. Anyway, so he really wants to play for the Utah Jazz, and he's not entirely sure how it works. Like, his thing to me, like, we were going to his, I took him to a soccer game, and we're going up there, driving up to a soccer game recently. And he's like, hey, Dad, do I have to pay to play for the Utah Jazz? He thinks it's like junior jazz
where you
have to pay. And so he's not entirely clear. And I'm like, yeah, I practice all this type of things. Like, I'm good enough now. I could probably play now.
I love that his skills translate in present day.
And it was funny, too, because he's like, if I can't make the Jazz, I'm going to play for the Bulls.
That's valid.
The Chicago Bulls.
It's basically like the lower level roster of the Jazz. Why not?
I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. If you can't get the Jazz, you could at least do the Bulls. Anyone can do the Bulls. That's easy. That's not going to be too much. So he's way into it. He doesn't feel like he's growing tall enough. He's like 9, right? He doesn't feel like he's tall enough to play in the NBA, which he's not. He's 9.
Yeah.
But he'll grow. I mean, his dad's 6'2". That's a strong guy.
That's like a Raul Neto, dude.
That's a Raul Neto. He could be a strong Raul Neto. Don't you think?
I do. I absolutely do.
He could be like a superior
version.
I'm not
going to rain on his dreams. That's not my job.
He has a good shot, actually.
You know,
at that age, it's hard to know if you're good or bad at basketball.
Yes.
But he can dribble it around and he can shoot it. Like a lot of people at that age can't do the dribble thing.
Yeah.
But he can do that and he can shoot it. So just keep practicing. Is that what you, what would you say? What advice do you have for him?
Yeah, keep practicing. This is, I got way uncomfortable as the dad there. I knew it was to dear dad. I'm like, well, I mean, do your homework first. And always keep the room door open, and you can't have internet past 8. I don't know what the rules are to getting in the NBA. No, this is spurring a story in my mind that I've told before on this podcast, but I do think is way funny because my mom is the nicest person on planet Earth. But for some reason, I would always do this. I was the same, literally the exact same as Ollie when I was young. And I go, I'm going to be in the NBA. And I think my mom just got sick of it or something. She's like, I got to listen to this little nerdy clown all day come in and try to drop sports stats on me. And I go, that's great. I'm glad that Tommy Frazier threw for 222 yards on Saturday. I love you, son.
And I go, but mom, you don't understand. They're running the option.
I'm like always doing this stuff to my mom because I just didn't understand the audience. So I'm like 8 years old, you know, just laying it on thick. And my poor mom does not care about sports. Mm. Very loving mom, treated me very nice. And so she's like, okay, that's great. Wow, Chris, you probably shouldn't eat that next can of chili, but you're doing good. And so for some reason, it just came to a head one day because as part of that, I always go, mom, I'm going to be a baller in the NBA. I can't. And she's looking at me, you know, some like 8-year-old roly-poly chili man. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to go practice more to get ready for the NBA. And for some reason, she just like had it. And she's like, now, Chris, you're not going to make it in the NBA. I just want to be up front with you. It's the only time my mom ever rained on my hopes and dreams. She's always like every other avenue. She goes, you know what? That's great. You should go and do your best and try. For some reason with the NBA, she's just like, look, I don't know anything about sports. You're way into Castleberry's chili, a brand that's actually discontinued. You're not making the NBA. I don't know how to say that. Like, throw yourself into your books, you know, get smarter, do something else. You got a lot of areas that you could maybe be more talented and do that. So every time I hear about these NBA hopes and dreams, I think it's way funny. Because I remember that. And I also think about the parent. And I'm like, do they ever get to the point? You might be different because you actually like sports. And so I think it would always be like an interesting just back and forth with your child. I think it's way funny for parents who don't care about sports at all. And they're like, in the back of their minds, they go, I hate freaking soccer. And you're not going to play on the United States national team. Stop talking to me about this. Like, what's the point they snap at?
I'm never throwing cold water on
No, it. I don't think you would
I'm
either.
Like, I think you're going to make – I'm the opposite. I know the owner of the Jets. I bet we could call him up.
You actually
see if he let you.
You text Ryan when he asks you that. You're like, Ryan, how much would it cost for my son Oliver in 15 years to play on the Jazz?
I think you got a good chance. We got an inside man there. Could be really good for us.
I think I could get you a tryout, dude.
I think it's like $50 and you get a jersey that comes with it.
I'll bring you up to the next like Zion's Bank extravaganza where we go and play horse against George Niang. And like maybe that's a way you can showcase your skills.
Ollie would love
catch
that.
The eye of Quinn Snyder, you know?
Yeah, and Quinn's like, who's this up and comer? Talk to me in 12 years.
Get back to me in 15 years there, pal.
Here's how to contact us. It's DearClint@TheBeehive.com. Call us 1-385-344-8011. Hit us up at the Beehive HQ, hashtag DearClint. Text us 1-720-704-4863. That's the show. Signing off for Chris Rall, Kelly Jensen, and Weston Tanner. My name is Clint Betts, and this has been another episode of The Beehive. Everyone, have a great weekend.